Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
A promotional fee has been paid by the sponsor of this program. For its editorial content, statements, views, and beliefs expressed by the sponsor do not reflect those of WOKV or Cox Media Group.
The Consumer Law Hour is brought to you by Farah and Farah.
The comments and opinions expressed on this radio program do not constitute legal advice and do not create an attorney-client relationship with you. If you have a legal problem, a formal consultation will be needed outside the confines of this radio program.
Helping to make our community a better place. This is the WOKV Ask the Experts Weekend, discussing the things that matter most to you. Have a question? Have it answered by our local experts. Call 340-1045. That's 340-1045. Now, the Consumer Law Hour with Eddie and Chuck Farah on News 104.5 WOKV.
Man, I don't know. I feel like it's been a bit over a month since we have had an official all three of us show finally for the Consumer Law Hour.
Yeah, the trifecta's back in action, Tim.
Man, one thing after another. Well, it's great to be on air with you guys.
Yeah, it's good
again.
To be back with everybody. We had a good show last week, and we had some people from our office that picked up the show, as you know, a couple of weeks while we were gone. But
they did really good. I was shocked. Not shocked because they did well, but just because being on air is different than not being on air, right?
Yeah, it is, but they like doing it. They listen to the show all the time, so they couldn't wait to get on.
Yeah, well, one of the guys drove all the way from, like, Gainesville.
Yeah,
something.
He did. Neil.
Yeah.
Gambler is his last name. Mm-hmm. I love that last name, Neil the Gambler. That's his real last name.
Yeah, I hope he plays rounds every once in a while. Yeah.
But I want to kind of pick up where we were last week, and we were talking about what happens if you lease your house out. Do you lose your homestead exemption? Because, as we know, the government's always looking for ways to get more money, and if you lose your homestead exemption, they get more money because you have to pay more property taxes. But Florida statute is pretty clear to a certain extent when it comes to leasing out your home. Typically, if you lease your house out after January 1st, let's say you lease it out on January 2nd, but it was homesteaded on January 1st, you lease it out for a year, you get to homestead it that entire year, even though you've leased out the home. But you can't do that 2 years in a row. So they give you 1 year kind of a free homestead exemption, even though you're leasing it out. So the question then becomes, what happens when you lease out part of your home? Let's say you're living in half of it and you're leasing out another half, or you've got maybe five bedrooms, you're leasing out three of the bedrooms, and you're still living there, and do you lose your homestead exemption? That's where there's some case law that's kind of vague when it comes to that. The statute says that you have to lease out your entire home to lose your homestead exemption. So you would think that, well, as long as I've got some of my stuff there, or I'm living there part-time or living there, claiming it, you know, as my home, then I can keep my homestead exemption. But there was a case up in Fernandina Beach where I don't know if it was a home or a condo, but this person leased it out, but he kept one closet with his stuff in it. And the tax collector came around and said, no, you've leased the house out. It's not your homestead. Therefore, we're going to, you know, up your property taxes. And he tried to argue that, well, under the statute, I didn't lease out the entire house. I kept this one closet with my personal effects in it. And the judge ruled, even though the statute says that, that one closet, I mean, just because you kept one closet doesn't mean that you didn't lease out the entire home. So he lost that case. So you want to be careful about trying to circumvent the statute by keeping something in the garage or opening, you know, keeping some stuff in a closet. You're better off maybe keeping a lot of stuff at the house and maybe staying there for some time during that period that you're renting it out if you can, or else you could lose your homestead exemption.
Now, this qualifies for like Airbnb people too?
Yeah, but you know, Airbnb, typically their people aren't there as long. Mm-hmm. But if they were going to be there for a year, if you did something for a year, then you would lose it.
Yeah, but it says that for Airbnb, I think, if you provide, let's see, there was a statute to provide that rental of all or substantially all of the dwelling shall mm-hmm. constitute abandonment of the homestead, mm-hmm. and that rental of the property for more than 30 days per calendar year for two consecutive years would result in abandonment of the homestead exemption.
There you go. Because, yeah, a lot of those, you know, people go on vacation for the summer or whatever. They go to their other homes and they Airbnb their places while they're gone.
Yeah. So, yeah, you're going to see, you know, the tax collectors, I wonder if they have access to the data as to who is leasing out their house under that Airbnb program. That way they can focus in on those people and maybe try to get some more tax dollars, which they love to do, as we all know. Moving on to another subject, and is, you know, we've kind of talked about the dog bite statute, the Florida dog bite statute, which basically is a strict liability statute, which means dog bites you, your dog bites somebody, you're basically strictly liable. You know, there are some exemptions, you know, exceptions to that. For instance, if you've got, one of them is if you've got a bad dog sign in your yard. If you've got a bad dog sign in your yard, you've kind of put the people on notice. If they come onto your property, they're assuming the risk. Now, there's an age limit. I think the age is 12. It doesn't apply for kids under 12. But generally, the bad dog sign, which you can put on your yard as long as it's visible and you've got enough of them so people can see it, is going to help you escape liability if somebody comes onto your property and you know, gets bit by your dog. Well, there was a case that came out, I think, here, and it's in here in Florida. I'm trying to think if it was in Duval. Or down, I think it was down south, maybe. Let me see where this case was. I think maybe in Fort Lauderdale somewhere, down south Florida. But what happened was there was a dog park, and the dog park had signs out there. You know, you sort of, you know, be careful, this is a dog park. And so this person's walking their dog in the dog park, and another dog starts chasing her dog. And as it's chasing her dog, it bumps into this person, hurts her. She breaks her arm, has a surgery. So she wants to sue the dog owner, and because, you know, the dog caused her this injury. But the dog owner alleged, hey, you know, look at these signs outside the dog park. These are equivalent to a bad dog sign in front of somebody's yard. Therefore, I have no liability. You assumed the risk by bringing your dog into the dog park. Well, the court said no. The court said the bad dog sign is a little different. That's typically on private property. And so the statute did not mean to include it to these dog parks. So this person was able to pursue her lawsuit against the owner, even though these signs outside the fence said you're basically assuming the risk when you bring your dog into this, you know, dog park area. So the moral to that story is that a lot of times, just like we learned in the house rental, the statute or the law may say one thing, but the way the courts interpret the statute or the law can be completely different. So that's why you need to get a legal opinion, because sometimes a lot of people do their own research. I see it so many times. They go on to the internet, they go on to Google, and they read the statute on some law, and they go, well, I'm in the right, or maybe I'm in the wrong, but they don't really know the interpretation of that statute. You know, if you look, if you do the correct research, like if you have Lexis or something of that nature where you can read the statute, then read the laws, the cases that interpret those statutes, then you have a better understanding of where you are when it comes to something like that. So that's why you always want to get a legal opinion when you think that maybe you're in the right or you have a cause of action, because it's not always the black and white is not always what it is. And that's because the law is a gray area. It's not black and white. It's more gray than it is black and white. So that's why we have this judicial system, and that's why a computer doesn't make the decision. People make decisions. Juries make decisions, and judges make decisions to interpret what the laws mean.
Well, you know where you can get a legal opinion.
Oh, well, yeah.
Like calling into the radio show, yeah. The Consumer Law Hour, here with Fair and Fair.
It's definitely a gray area over here. We're always looking for the right answer, but we do the best we can.
Sure.
So I don't know if you have a phone call waiting.
Not yet, but the phone lines are open, 904-340-1045, 904-340-1045.
Yep. So anyway, there was an interesting case that came out of Ohio. You know, there was a guy who was, back in 1994, you know, he's having fallen on some hard times. He had a drinking issue. He lost his job. So he leaves town and he disappears. Okay. He just leaves his family. He leaves his wife and the kids. So the wife goes to court and has him declared legally dead, you know, because otherwise she can't get, you know, social security death benefits and any other benefits that she may have coming to her. So a few years ago, he comes back recently, you know, he wants to get back, you know, back into society again, because he wants to, you know, if he's declared dead, he can't get a social security number. And if you're declared dead, you can't get a driver's license. The dead person can't have those two things. So he comes back to court and he goes, "Judge, you need to declare me undead so I can get a driver's license and get a social security number." And the court rules that since so much time had passed that he was still declared legally dead. And the wife objected to the judge doing, you know, bringing him back alive again, because the wife was concerned that for 20 years, she's been getting Social Security benefits, and if he wasn't dead, she'd have to pay all that money back to the government.
Oh, my God.
So anyway, it's an interesting little twist of facts. But, I mean, I'm sure he could argue due process that he wasn't put on notice, or, you know, he could try to...
Well, he's not dead.
He's not dead. But according to the judge, the statute of limitations had run on him fighting the fact that whether or not he was dead, and therefore... And so case ended, yeah, it's a case out of Ohio. Now, Florida has an interesting statute. I'll read it to you. We've got a phone call, but let's. Florida statute says that evidence as to death, 731.103, a person who is absent from the place of his or her last domicile for a continuous period of 5 years and whose absence is not satisfactorily explained after diligent search and inquiry, is presumed to be dead. So if you're absent for 5 years, nobody can explain where you are, you've done a diligent search and inquiry, you can be determined dead, and you can go collect life insurance,
life insurance,
Social
that's
Security,
a big,
everything. Inherit, yeah. You can go inherit all the property, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So obviously, that's what happened in Ohio. I don't know what the law would be in Florida, but this guy is out of luck. He can't get a source, you know.
Just thought, I ain't dead, man.
I'm not dead. You know. But he goes down to the driver's license.
Does that mean
bureau,
he doesn't have to
say
pay
you are dead?
Does he not have to pay taxes then?
Yeah, but he can't get a social security number. He can't work.
Wow, I guess legally.
He's in a jam right now.
Yeah. Well, the phone lines are open.
Anyway.
904-340-1045, fair and fair here in the studio.
We'll talk about anything over here.
Taking this over to Donald over on the north side. We appreciate you calling in.
Hey, Donald.
Hi, how you doing?
Hey, Donald.
I had a question. I had bought a home at the end of last year. I'm a home builder, and come to find out about a month ago, my house was in violation with the city of Jacksonville under the PUD that the housing development was built under. And they didn't tell me that till later, and my survey shows that everything was fine. And come to find out, they built the house 7 foot over a BRL line, and the home builder basically wants me to sign paperwork that everything's okay, and they'll get it passed to the city, but we paid extra for this lot, and they're not really holding up their end of the bargain as far as what I paid for. I'm just kind of seeking some advice on how I should handle it.
Well, you know, we're a personal injury firm, but... this is more of a real estate issue. You know, you can talk to the Jacksonville Bar Association, and they have an attorney referral service. We've talked about that before. For $50, you can talk to a real estate lawyer for a half hour about that legal issue. Because you have to be careful. I mean, is he going to produce something from the city waiving any kind of infringement on that?
Well, gotten with the city, basically they would approve our house the way it's set, but that's not the intention of us buying our house. In the contract that I signed, it says if they can't build a house on that lot for whatever reason, that they would find another lot that they could build that home if it was available. But there's nothing in the contract that says if they build a house and then come out later that the house is in violation. But we had intentions of, you know, doing other modifications to the home at a later point. That's why we paid a premium for this lot that had more space.
Yeah. Well, what are your damages right now? You have the house you wanted. What are your losses at this point? And if you were to go in front of a jury or a judge, what would you tell them you've lost?
Well,
if the city approves it, says you can keep it as is, huh?
Well, the house as is originally on my survey says I can build up to 10 feet of the property line. In reality, it was supposed to be 20 feet from the property line. So that leaves no room for any kind of any future improvements as far as a pool. I can't build a screened-in enclosure. I can't build anything in the backyard based on that information.
Okay, then.
And I have to disclose that if I ever sold the home, and that wasn't disclosed to me.
Okay, so you're going to be limited to what you can build. So the surveyor, you would maybe have a cause of action against them, and of course the builder. If your damages are, unless the city will waive all that in the future because you were under the impression you could build on it.
Well, they got approval from the city to have our house stand as it is, and that's what the paperwork they wanted me to sign, but they didn't take into consideration that's not what they sold me. And I have paperwork showing that our house was the most expensive lot that they were selling.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to pick every single lot on property almost whenever we put our contract down.
Mm-hmm.
So we had other options, but that's not what they sold us at this point.
Well, I mean, you would have, it depends how far you want to push it. You probably do have a cause of action. You probably, most of the contracts these days have an arbitration provision in them, which will limit your ability to file the lawsuit against the builder. You need to check the statute, the contract, and see if there's an arbitration. And if it is, you're going to have to go that route. But
it didn't say anything about arbitration. Like there's a paragraph that states if they can't build on this lot due to regulations, that we would, go through basically
an arbitration
to find another lot. Right.
Yeah.
Well, it didn't say arbitration. But.
Well, I mean, I think you need to talk to a lawyer who really specializes in that area. I don't know, Tim, do you have that Jack's Bar Association number?
Yeah, the Jack's Bar Association, that is 904-399-4486. Again, that's 904-399-4486. Coming up, more listener questions on the Consumer Law Hour with News 104.5 WOKV. We're back. The Consumer Law Hour, right here on News 104.5 WOKV. Eddie and Chuck here in the studio. My name's Tim Tompkins, and yes, Scott Kushner is behind the boards producing the show for us right now. The phone lines, they are open. 904-340-1045, 904-340-1045. Let's take this over to John in San Marco. John, thanks for calling in.
Hey, John.
Hey, first off, three cheers for the brothers who really help. Sacrificing your Saturday to help the folks of Jacksonville. I really appreciate that very much. My question is, my mom and I own a property, and if she dies, I get the house. And if I die, of course, she gets it. Can she change those terms, like give it to my brother without my notification?
Is your name on the deed right now?
We own the house outright, and, it's either if she dies, it goes to me, and vice versa.
How does it read on the deed? Do you know what it reads like? Does it say joint tenants in common, or upon my death, it goes to my son?
Upon my death, it goes to my son. Essentially, like that.
Okay, if she has a life estate, which means she owns it while she's living, and it goes to you upon her death, all she can sell or get rid of is the house during her lifetime.
Okay.
You see what I'm
saying? She's not going to try to cheat me out of the house. I'm just worried about my brother getting control of the house when she dies.
It depends. If the deed is written where she and you own it right now, but upon her death it goes to you.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I got to see the wording of the deed. But if it does, he can't get it. He can get a life estate. She can give away her share while she's alive. He can live in it. But then upon her death, it goes to you.
Well, if she can do that while she's alive, will I have to be notified of it?
Not really. She can do it on her own. But who would want that? I mean, what would she want to, God forbid, you want your mother, but why would she give it away just while she's alive? I mean, if she doesn't own it, it depends how you own it. If she owns half of it and you own half of it, she can give away her half. I got to see what the deed looks like.
Yeah, okay.
Now, if you want to send me a copy of the deed, I can have somebody look at it and tell you for sure.
We own it 50-50, and okay. It goes to whoever survives, but I'm just wondering
if that case,
she had to notify me.
In that case, she can file a deed. If it's 50-50, she can probably take a quick claim deed and say, I give my half to my son, my other son, and file it at the courthouse, and then your partner's with him. But I got to see what it looks like.
Okay.
If you want to send it to me, I can have somebody look at it and tell you.
Phone lines are open, 904-340-1045. Coming up, we have your news update with Action News.
John, stick on. I'll tell you how it should be worded when you get back.
A bit of local news as weather, as well as a look at your drive heading out to the beaches. Don't go anywhere. Back, the Consumer Law Hour with Fair and Fair right here on News 104.5 WOKV. Eddie and Chuck here in the studio. The phone lines, they are open. 904-340-1045, 904-340-1045. Taking this over to Richard. Hi, Richard.
Hey, how you doing? I was had a question. What's the statute of limitation on a workman's comp case?
I think it's 2 years. Is it 2 years from the date of last treatment?
Yeah, I believe it is.
I think it's, I can find out the definitive answer. We'll try to get our workers' comp lawyer on the line. What's the issue? Maybe I can answer it for you.
The issue is I believe I got injured at work. I wound up in the hospital, and I had multiple surgeries done on my foot. I about lost my leg. I've actually lost my job, and I filed for disability, and I was awarded disability, and just trying to figure out if I had it.
How long ago has it been?
How do you think, why do you think it's related to work? I mean, was it something that was a delayed symptom?
I went to work and I was supposed to go work one night and I wound up real sick and I wound up in the hospital. Then I went back to the hospital 2 days later. They cut my foot open for flesh eating bacteria disease. And I was working for a company that, goes in and out of the mills, and there's times I was cleaning out trucks, and I got that, I don't know.
So you think you contracted it while you were at work?
Yes.
How long ago has it been?
The last time I worked was November 8th of 2016.
Yeah, you may have some time.
And the last treatment I had was like in 2017.
Did you ever report it as a workers' comp?
No.
Okay. All right. So I'll tell you, why don't you leave your phone number with Scott, and I can have a workers' comp attorney talk to you on Monday.
Okay, that'll work.
Okay, thanks.
Appreciate that phone call.
It's something we can look at. When in doubt, you should always report it as a workers' comp accident.
Yeah.
That's what you, when in doubt. Mm-hmm. It doesn't cost you anything to report it. And it's on a record.
Yeah.
But we'll see what we can do to help Richard out.
And no, it's illegal to have any repercussions from that, right?
No, there's no, he's not doing anything wrong.
The company that has the workers' comp, the employer can't do anything because you filed a workers' comp.
Well, he's not working right now.
Yeah.
He's out of a job. He's trying to get disability.
Oh,
and he's sustained a serious injury, and if it's from the job. But I want to get back to what we got Lynn, hold on just for a second, but we get back to what John was talking about with his mom and his, and on the deed. If they own it equally, then yes, she can, give away her half, and he would be partners with her, with whoever she gives it to. But if she, the way to do it is to structure it on the deed, and this will allow it to pass without probate. In his situation, if they're each 50% owners and she wanted him to get it upon her death, he would have to go through a probate to get that done. But if he listed on the deed, or if the deed read that she had a life estate, and then upon her death, it would go to him. Upon her death, it would go to him automatically without probate. Also, people would be reluctant to take her share because they would only own it while she was alive if she just had a life estate. So there are ways to structure the deed to accomplish what you want, but you really got to talk to a lawyer about it. I don't know if John's still listening. If he wants to send me a copy of the deed, I can have a real estate lawyer take a look and give him a call back. So, but let's go ahead and Lynn.
Yep, Lynn, over on the south side, we appreciate you calling in.
Hey, Lynn.
Hey. I own a loan for my adult daughter's car, but the car title and insurance are in her name. If she were to have a serious accident, would I have any liability for that?
If the title's in her name alone, no, you would not, even though you're on the loan documents.
Okay, that's all I needed to know.
Yeah, because everything goes back to the title. Okay.
Okay, great.
So if you're not on the title, then you don't have the liability. You just co-sign for the loan. Okay?
All right. Thank you.
You know, Tim, we've talked about these cases before. There are situations where people get, they never take their name off the title. They go through a divorce. They forget to take their name off the title. They give it to their wife. The wife has an accident, and then they want to come back and sue the ex-husband and the wife.
You've brought the stories up about that before. But, you know, it must happen often.
If you don't have beneficial ownership, then you can't, you know, you escape liability also in that situation. There's a case that happened right here in Jacksonville where that was the scenario. It happened on Butler Boulevard. It was a bad accident. The husband forgot to transfer the car into the wife's name after the divorce. They tried to sue the husband. He argued, hey, listen, we're divorced. I don't have the keys. I don't have the use of the car. It's called beneficial ownership. And he was able to escape liability under that argument. So, again, you go back, you read the statutes, you read the laws, but you got to read the cases that interpret those laws to really know where you stand.
I'm glad the law works out in people's favors.
Yeah, it works.
904-340-1045, 904-340-1045 to get a call in to Chuck or Eddie.
Yeah. You know, there's a case the Supreme Court ruled last month, interesting case dealing with cell phone records. And this guy was arrested for armed robbery. And the U.S. attorney or the attorney, the state attorney, subpoenaed all his cell phone records where he was, I mean, his physical locations for 127 days surrounding the robberies. And he looked, I mean, he was able to go to whoever the carrier was, and they subpoenaed all his cell phone records. They could figure out, I guess, by the cell towers where he was. And they probably tried to connect those, his physical locations to where the robberies occurred. And he was convicted, and he ended up going to prison. Well, he argued that that was an illegal search and seizure, a violation of the Fourth Amendment, because they didn't obtain a warrant. Mm-hmm. I mean, they just went and subpoenaed it. And this went up to all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the U.S. Supreme Court threw out the conviction. He got out of jail because the U.S. attorney or the state attorney had violated his constitutional rights of illegal search and seizure. So the state tried, even though he didn't turn, you know, usually typically when you look at search and seizure, it's you turning over the stuff or they're coming into your car without a warrant. But what they did in this situation, they went directly to the cell phone carrier without him probably even knowing about it.
Yeah, without notice. Yeah, that's
without any kind of notice. So the court said, even though they went to a third party, they didn't come to you to get the records.
It's like you're storing your information with a third party.
Yeah, and that you still have the protection of the Fourth Amendment with the...
I'm surprised the cell phone companies didn't have him waive that when he signed up, but...
I don't know. Maybe they do. I don't know if you do waive it when you sign it, but you're giving up your rights of privacy. I don't know if that would be not a good thing. I mean,
no.
That's something that shouldn't be in the fine print. That should be in the bold print.
Right.
So anyway, he won. The law worked for him, and he's out of jail.
You guys want to talk about 3D printing since we don't have caller right now?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yes. You know, as we know, as of August, this is an interesting case because it kind of came out of the blue. And the person, there's a guy in Texas. His name is, he's a former law student. His name's Cody Wilson. And he has these blueprints. And he's going to be able now legally, as of August 1st, to publish the blueprints to make guns from a 3D printer. And the person that was suing him to stop him was the U.S. State Department, which I kind of thought was strange. What's the State Department have to do with that? But there's a law that prevents you from exporting military articles, and I guess to prevent companies from, you know, selling guns and armaments to countries that we don't want to have them. So it was the State Department that was suing him to prevent him from putting this stuff online. Well, he won that lawsuit. All of a sudden, the State Department just dropped it. There's no rhyme or reason. It just came out of the blue that, you know, we're not going to pursue this anymore. And as a matter of fact, the State Department ended up paying him $40,000 to cover his lawyer expenses. But not only is he going to give you the pistol, the blueprints for the pistol, which he calls the Liberator, and he describes himself as a crypto anarchist. He wants to get rid of all kind of gun control. He goes, with these 3D printers, there will be no longer any gun control because anybody can make anything. As a matter of fact, he has the blueprints to make... he's going to post the blueprints for an AR-15. So even that can be created by a 3D printer.
Yeah, but they can only fire
one bullet at a time.
Right. Yeah, and when I say only, one bullet can do a lot of damage.
Yeah.
You know, we've all known. People have died.
Keep reloading it.
Right. But, people have died from getting shot once.
But he's thinking. He's thinking ahead. He goes, he's getting ready to sell a milling machine called the Ghost Gunner, which allows people to carve guns out of aluminum. So he's ramping it up. He's not finished. I mean, now you got the 3D printer. My question is, does the plastic withstand the pressure of the bullet? That's what I mean, nobody's really answered that. I don't know if there are any gun people out there listening
in. Well, this was current event this week, current news.
Well, I know that, but can
it showed it shooting.
It did?
Oh, yeah.
And it withstood the pressure of the plastic?
Yeah,
okay.
Yes.
Also, is it totally plastic? Because what I'm reading here is
there's one piece of metal, I believe.
Yes, there has to be. There's a federal statute called the Undetectable Firearms Act that requires the firing pin to be made out of metal. So that way it'll be detectable in a, you know, if you're going through the airport or somewhere, or through a metal detector. But this is really an interesting situation. I mean, to be able to make an AR-15 with a 3D printer, and he's going to have those plans online also. Now he's got the green light, basically. You know, there's no federal statute that prevents you from making your own firearm, your own gun. Make your own gun. There's no law against it. Does that mean you can make your own cannon, your own tank? I guess. But
yeah, 3D printer.
3D printer. Oh, yeah. Listen, you can make anything with a 3D printer these days. So
I heard about them trying to make cars with 3D printers. Yeah, I'm just like, what is going on with these things?
I know. It's amazing. But so we'll see how that goes. You know, yeah, they did fire it. I don't know.
The printer cuts it out, molds it, and everything.
Puts it together. Yeah, it's like a computerized. No human. There's no human factors.
You know, you plug in the
it's got all the plans. The materials.
And it's going to make a BB gun.
Yeah,
some of those are plastic.
So he was facing jail, but he beat it. And it was interesting. They don't know how, all of a sudden the State Department just abandoned
the
claim.
So it's currently legal.
They abandoned the lawsuit. And this guy was facing jail time.
So it's currently legal now. So
as of August 1st, he can publish online
all the
blueprints, all the plans. And you can go get a 3D printer, get the materials, and make your own. And soon make your own AR-15.
Well, yay for plastic gun rights, right?
Okay. All right. I thought that was kind of interesting.
904-340-1045 if you want to get a call in, maybe comment on your views on plastic gun rights.
Yeah.
That's not the end of it, though. You'll hear another lawsuit. Maybe there was a defect in this that they needed to dismiss it
to make sure
that they get the right case to prosecute, you know?
Well, there's no serial numbers. There's no...
Well, once it's out on the internet, once it's out there forever.
It's here forever. Yeah. Yeah. You can't get rid of it. Yeah, they can get rid of it. Yeah, there's no.
Let's go over to we have John in San Marco. John, thanks for calling in.
Yes, hi. I just got a call. I talked to you all a few minutes ago, but I just got a call from a supposed IRS agent that said they were going to come to my house with an arrest warrant within the next hour if I don't respond to this number in the next 30 minutes.
I got one too. Hold on.
I get those.
We get them too.
Okay, so I just want to let people know that I'm sure you call it that number, you probably end up stuck for a lot of money. So
I know.
I just wanted to kind of get the word out there. That's the first time it's ever happened to me, and I know it's just I listen to Clark Howard enough to know that's a total scam.
Yeah, I'll tell you something else. I know people that have given them money. That's how bad
I know,
it is.
And that's why I called right away. I just got it, and I just called you while you're still in there, and God bless you guys. Thank you.
I don't think the IRS would ever call you about anything.
No.
It would all be written in a letter, with a number to contact them.
Same with the JEA. So I used to do the Q&A with JEA show. And so a lot of scammers, when they're trying to scam the JEA customers, who they're actually targeting is the people that don't speak English, the business owners, they can scare them into saying, if you don't give us this money right now, we're going to shut off your bill. And, of course, these people come from different countries where they aren't sure that's not how things work. Mm-hmm. And so they fall for it.
Hey, Daniel.
Yeah, let's go ahead and take a break. That way we have time to get to Daniel when we get back and we don't have to cut him off. You're listening to the Consumer Law Hour with Farrah and Farrah right here on News 104.5 WOKV. You're tuned in to the Consumer Law Hour with Farrah and Farrah. Let's take this over to Robert over on the South Side. Robert, thanks for calling in.
I was just wondering if I was involved in an accident at fault or I was in an accident with somebody else's fault. When the person's injured, say they have $100,000 worth of coverage and I'm hurt worse than that or they're hurt worse than that,
where does the other money come from if that's all the policy gives?
Yeah, you bring up a good point. I mean, if you're at fault and all you have is 100 and the claim is worth $500,000, they're going to be looking to get the money from you.
Where? Like,
well, if you have
personal assets.
Personal assets. You may have money in the bank. You may have property
land
that's not homesteaded. You may have, I mean, you may be getting ready to inherit money. I mean,
this is why it's important.
So they could actually go after money that you would inherit?
If you're inheriting money, they know you're, I mean, they can go, if there's a probate pending and they go look at the inventory and they go, wow, Robert's going to inherit $200,000. You know, there may be a way for them to get to that unless you can protect it before you, you know, before they attach it. I mean, there are ways to protect it, but I mean, generally it depends how aggressive they want to be.
It's important to have, it's really, you need an umbrella if you can afford it, and it's not very expensive, but an umbrella policy is very important to have because that protects you for pretty much, you know, as $1 million will protect you most of the time. So you won't have to pay anything out of pocket. And then if you're the injured person, you've got to have uninsured motorist coverage. That's what protects you against the person who has limited coverage if they injure you.
Okay, could I go after somebody else's IRA if they had one?
No, that's exempt. The IRA is usually exempt.
Yeah,
401Ks, okay. Things like that, pensions.
Homestead, annuities. There's a whole list of things you can't attach.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Sure, man.
Hope you're
never in
that
situation.
Daniel, over on the west side.
Hey, Daniel.
What's up, man? All right, doesn't look like Daniel's there, but maybe we can answer his question.
Well, medical matter, he wants to know where the shop. There are shops in town. There are shops in the area. You can go online and find out where they are. You can't just walk in and purchase medical marijuana. You've got to have a medical marijuana card, which means you got to go through a process to get it. It's issued by the state. And once you have the card, then it entitles you to purchase medical marijuana for a certain period of time. So there are doctors in town that can qualify you for the medical marijuana card. You can probably go online and find them and make an appointment, and hopefully you'll qualify.
Well, first episode in the books after the extended break.
At least we know how to get here. We have to use Google Maps to get back to the studio.
And we'll be back next week, another episode of the Consumer Law Hour, answering your legal questions every Saturday at noon. Eddie and Chuck here in the studio. My name is Tim Tompkins. Thanks so much to our producer, Scott Kushner. Look at your drive heading out to the beaches coming up.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.